The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
When we set out to do a story about the man the Houston press called the Bluebeard of Houston, we had no idea what we were getting into. This episode is not about that man, but we'll get to him soon enough. There is an almost unbelievable, scandalous, and murderous mythology surrounding the main subject of this series. This episode and the next is about a figure who makes an appearance, albeit a brief one. When a woman named Candy came up in our research, her story was impossible to ignore. It certainly helps provide insight into a bigger picture, Houston's high society, and how several individuals privileged enough to be a part of it appears, have gotten away with murder. Some, perhaps, more than once. Candy Mosler is one of those individuals, and it's not only because she makes a small appearance in the story of the Bluebeard of Houston that we decided to preface this series with her. It's also because the murder of Candy's husband, Houston, Texas multimillionaire Jacques Mosler, remains unsolved, technically, though Candy's role in it seems certain. Jacques' murder didn't happen in Texas. Rather, he was slain in Florida. It was a case the Miami Herald said, quote, had all the elements of a sick society raised to the nth power, a phantasmagoria of sex and slaughter. Candy had come a long way before marrying Houston millionaire Jacques Mosler. She was born Candace Grace Weatherby in Buchanan, Georgia, on February 18, 1920, to parents Lonnie and Lizzie Weatherby. Candy grew up on the family farm there, along with her 12 siblings, 7 brothers and 6 sisters, of which she was the 7th born. The Weatherby family was poor. Her parents, of course, farmers, and her grandfather, a bishop in the Mormon Church. She recovered from polio after contracting the disease at age 8, a fact that was largely contributed to Candy's strong will. But tragedy struck when Candy was 12. Her mother died of a drug overdose and her father split, leaving the children with their maternal grandparents and starting a new family just a county away. Candy weathered the tragedy, and that strong will didn't hurt the poor farmer's daughter's eventual rise up the social ladder. Candy Weatherby was small, described often as pixie-like. She was a quintessential Southern belle. As she grew into adulthood, her voice remained almost childlike, and her heavy Georgia country girl drawl and bubbly personality made her about as charming as they come. Candy kept her hair platinum blonde and had big blue eyes. She was a larger-than-life personality, almost a character, one reporter said, like she'd been lifted straight out of a Tennessee Williams script. Everyone loved her, and Candy is said to have driven men crazy. Though she portrayed herself as fragile, that was likely just to make her suitors feel like big protective men, a pitch-perfect trick among the many others in, perhaps, Candy's greatest skill set, the act of manipulation. When Candy was 20 years old, she married 28-year-old Norman Johnson, a civil engineer. The couple had 2 children together, Rita and Norman Jr. They moved to New York City not long after the marriage, where Candy picked up modeling gigs for a toothpaste company. Perfect teeth, apparently, was another attribute of the farmer's daughter. Candy also designed ads for Vogue and Bazaar magazines. In 1945, Candy and Norman Johnson moved to New Orleans, Louisiana. Upon opening the Candace Modeling School and Agency, Candy was introduced to the city's social elites and easily wooed New Orleans socialites with her indelible Southern charm. She was born the daughter of a poor Georgia farmer, but you almost wouldn't know it. Candy learned sophistication and absorbed high culture. She could hold her own in a room full of old money types, even without trying. In 1948, fundraisers for the New Orleans Grand Opera Company welcomed Candy with open arms when she volunteered to help. Considering her personality, the charm I keep mentioning, it was a no-brainer to task Candy with visiting New Orleans millionaire businessmen to solicit donations. That's how Candy Weatherby Johnson met Jacques Mosler. Born in Galați, Romania on May 6, 1896, Jacques Moscovici, later to change his last name to Mosler, came to America with his family as a little boy. The Moscovicis were Jewish and fled Romania to escape persecution, something always pervasive there, but violence against Jews was escalating at the time. Around 1908, his parents separated, and Jacques, his siblings, and mother moved from Buffalo, New York, to Chicago. Jacques quit school at age 13 to help his mother support him and his siblings. Though this was a terrible turn of events as far as the boy's education, making money was an easy task for the enterprising Jacques. He was inarguably born to do it. On the commuter trains of Chicago, Illinois, little Jacques Mosler peddled candy to the passengers. He sold newspapers on the Chicago Loop. It was another endeavor, however, that would prove to be most prophetic. Jacques Mosler dabbled on the side as a street corner teenage loan shark, lending out cash to other kids who were in a pinch, with, of course, interest. When he turned 18, Jacques got a job as an auto mechanic at a Chicago dealership. He quickly graduated to salesman, but his goal was to work the dealership's finance department. If you're getting the drift here, it will come as no surprise to you that it took no time for management to realize that financing was exactly where Jacques Mosler belonged. So, that's where he went. He made do through the Great Depression, and while the nation was in recovery, Jacques opened a small chain of modest financing companies. By the end of World War II, as soldiers came back to their lives and families, Jacques Mosler owned about 40 finance and insurance firms, ready to loan the nation's returning heroes some scratch for a car, house, appliances, or anything else they might need. The Mutual National Bank of Chicago and Trust of Miami were among others scattered around Chicago, Illinois, and South Florida. The Yes Banks, as the slogan went. Others could be found in Houston, Texas, and New Orleans, Louisiana. Work wasn't work to Jacques Mosler. He loved what he did, and he was always at it. By 1947, the Romanian immigrant whose family had come to the land of opportunity when he was a young boy was a multimillionaire. When Candy Weatherby Johnson began phoning the city's businessmen looking for charitable donations to the New Orleans Grand Opera Company, Jacques Mosler was on that list. The Big Easy was just one of the cities he resided and owned banks in. Although Jacques had no personal interest in opera, he did realize its cultural significance, he told Candy when she paid him a visit. Jacques wrote her out a check for significantly less than she was expecting, just $25, and quickly changed the subject to all things candy, forgetting about the purpose for her visit altogether. Right away, the two discovered that they had one major thing in common. Candy was recently divorced, and Jacques was in the process of divorcing his wife. The age difference between Candy and Jacques might have been the elephant in the room. She was just 28 years old, and he was 52, but neither seemed to notice. She reminded Jacques of Marilyn Monroe, her southern charm, vivaciousness, platinum locks, and elegant clothing, though Candy's style was a little more casual than the model and actress. Candy certainly oozed class, and again drove every man she ever met crazy, but Jacques was no slouch. While folks called Candy out of Jacques' league, the man was indeed a catch on many levels. Jacques Mosler was humble, refined, well-dressed, and handsome. I don't know if Candy thought so or not, but the man at least slightly resembled fellow Romanian Bela Lugosi, one of the greatest horror movie actors that ever lived. It certainly didn't hurt that Jacques was loaded. Anyway, it didn't matter what the outside world thought. Both were smitten with one another. 6 months after Candy and Jacques met, on May 24, 1949, they got hitched. Since Candy and Jacques had 6 kids between them, and even more help, like groundskeepers, chefs, drivers, and housekeepers, the newlywedded couple needed a lot of space. Jacques, too, wanted to be close to his business headquarters in Houston, Texas. They settled for a 28-room mansion in River Oaks, a section of Houston exclusive to the bustling city's social elites and upper crust. Since Jacques Mosler also conducted a significant amount of business and social hobnobbing in Miami, the couple bought an apartment in Florida's Key Biscayne, a tropical barrier island just across the causeway from Miami. Candy was always stylish and elegant, but now there were few who could compare, as Jacques lavished her with the finest jewelry and designer clothing. And of course, they both rode around in style, in sporty Ford Thunderbirds, luxury Cadillacs, and fast Jaguars. Jacques and Candy Mosler were fixtures in Houston's elite social circle, always attending charity functions for the Houston Grand Opera and the Texas Children's Hospital, among others. Candy quickly became known as the favorite host of visiting celebrities, and took a particular interest in the Houston Fat Stock Show and Rodeo. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find a corner of Houston at stock show time that didn't have a billboard featuring Candy herself leathered up in cowgirl gear, ads for the rodeo she purchased herself. And Candy Mosler could easily afford it. Besides the $5,000 Jacques would give her on her birthday, wedding anniversary, or whatever other special occasion, was the $5,700 monthly allowance. That would be about $62,000 a month in 2021. Though Jacques showered his wife with gifts and money, she wanted more. But not more of those things. Candy wanted more children. Jacques, however, had undergone a vasectomy surgery after the birth of his 4th daughter when he became paranoid he'd impregnate one of his flings and be blackmailed as a result. Apparently, Jacques enjoyed the occasional infidelity during his 1st marriage, but it should be noted we were unable to determine if he ever cheated on Candy. After 8 years of what was described as a happy, healthy marriage, death touched the couple's life for the first time. While in Chicago on business in 1957, Jacques Mosler picked up the Tribune and was horrified by a story within the newspaper. The article's headline read, "Arrest Bears Wife Slaying, Fatal Stabbing." 35-year-old World War II veteran Leonard Glenn had a history of psychosis, at least after he came home from battle. In 1954, Leonard was admitted to a psychiatric hospital and determined to be dangerous. Acutely disturbed, doctors said, withdrawn and incoherent, and the man required restraint. He was held and treated for almost 2 years, until in 1956, when his wife Betty requested his release, most likely due to hardship. The couple had 5 children at that point, 1 an infant. The Glens were poor, destitute, and lived in what was called indescribable filth. Betty soon regretted asking for her husband's release. His behavior was growing more erratic, and his chronic alcoholism was out of control. Leonard refused her requests that he check himself back into the hospital. Pregnant again with the couple's sixth child, it's unlikely Betty could have foreseen the horror her husband's mental health condition had in store. On Wednesday, January 9th, 1957, Leonard Glenn entered the living room where his wife and six-year-old daughter, Martha, slept. Little Martha later recalled hearing two shots. Daddy shot Mommy in the head with his rifle. All the children woke up, of course, at the sound of the gunfire, and their father laid the rifle behind a bookcase against the wall and left the home. The following morning, Leonard returned, woke up the children, and fed them breakfast. He kept the kids in the home with their mother's lifeless, bloodied body until the next day, Friday the 11th, when he packed them in the family car and told them they were going to Tennessee. But at some point before they left, he had stabbed his six-month-old son, Alexander, in the abdomen. It was a brutally cold January day in Chicago, the temperatures sub-zero, and as Leonard aimlessly drove the city's downtown and suburban streets, he refused to turn on the vehicle's heater, even as two of the children had no shoes and two no coats. Not long after Leonard Glenn crashed into a snowbank, Chicago patrol officers discovered the stuck vehicle and the frostbitten children inside. Infant Alexander, who'd been stabbed, was clothed in a snowsuit and barely clinging to life. Leonard told the officers that a spirit visited him, told him his wife was cheating on him, and that he'd shot her. He'd cut open his wife after, and then his baby, in search of the evil spirits within them. But he became incoherent, telling the cops he'd stabbed his baby because he thought his wife was still alive. She wouldn't die, Leonard said, so if he could not kill her, he'd kill the infant. He became irrational and then violent, and Leonard Glenn was quickly restrained and taken into custody. The children were rushed to the hospital. Though 6-year-old Martha, 5-year-old Daniel, 4-year-old Christopher, and 2-year-old Edward were treated for frostbite and would be just fine, 6-month-old Alexander died from the stab wound his father inflicted. This story disturbed Jacques Mosler. He became very upset. He could not bear the thought of these four orphans living in homes and possibly being separated after the horror they'd already endured. Within weeks of the slaying of Betty and Alexander Glenn, the surviving Glenn children were adopted by and living with Candy and Jacques in Houston, Texas. The adoption not only saved the children from a tumultuous and possibly irreparably devastating life, it mended one of the only issues in Jacques and Candy's marriage, her wish to have more kids when he could not give them to her. By the early 1960s, Houston, Texas was a behemoth. In the previous decade, a plethora of the surrounding small towns had been swallowed up by the big city, annexed and dubbed Houston suburbs. At the tail end of the 1950s, the city got its own professional football team, the Houston Oilers. In 1961, NASA began plans to build the Manned Spacecraft Center, now known as the Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center, in the southeastern corner of the city. The following year came a Major League Baseball team, the Colt 45s. That would be changed to the Astros only 2 years later. Oil production and petrochemical companies were long established in the Lone Star State's most populous city. Jacques Mosler, owner of a chain of banks and finance companies from Houston to Miami, was also doing quite well for himself. By that time, he was worth about $33 million. To say the self-made man was successful is an incredible understatement. He had apartments in Miami and Chicago, an apartment at the Governor's Lodge in Key Biscayne, a ranch in rural Texas, a beach house in Galveston, and, of course, his 28-room mansion in Houston. You didn't want for anything in the Mosler family, especially if you were Jacques' prized spouse. But he also knew that generosity to his employees was an important aspect to staying successful. Jacques set up a foundation to pay for schooling if his employees wished to attend and had pension funds for them. Jacques had everything going for him. He and Candy were over a decade into their marriage. Together, they had a large family, plenty of kids to dote on. In 1961, however, when Melvin Lane Powers came to town, everything came crashing down. Melvin, or Mel, was 19 years old when he came to Houston, and he was what you might call a specimen. He had jet black hair, a square jaw, pouty lips, and high cheekbones. At 6 feet 4 inches tall and the muscular build of an NFL linebacker, Mel looked like the perfect leading man for a television western or tough guy action flick. After high school in Birmingham, Alabama, Mel served in the Navy briefly. When he got out, he moved to Pontiac, Michigan, where he took back up the job he had during high school, door-to-door magazine sales. This time, however, was different. He wasn't a salesman at all, nor were the several others he'd concocted this ruse with. There were no magazines for sale. But the ruse didn't have a big payoff. Mel and his cohorts, though, soon learned of one. There was a friendly, elderly widower in the township of Oakland who was an easy target, they found out, and the phony salesman convinced him to buy stock in their magazine sales company. The 89-year-old man thought it sounded good and gave the young men a series of checks totaling $20,000. Think $183,000 in 2021 money. But, of course, there was no stock. These guys were scum, and the widower had been swindled. When the cops caught on to this scam, Mel was arrested in St. Louis, Missouri, and brought back to Michigan. He was convicted after spending a couple months in the county jail. Melvin Lee Powers was given 2 years probation and quickly headed to Houston, Texas, upon his release. That's where his mother Elizabeth's little sister, Candy Mosler, lived. Now, Aunt Candy had a soft spot for guys like her nephew, what you'd call hard cases. In 1958, she served on a grand jury that indicted a young man named Howard Stickney for a brutal double murder. Stickney killed a married couple, who were his friends, with a tire iron before bringing the woman back to her apartment and defiling her corpse. After his 1959 conviction and death sentence, Candy solicited her wealthy friends for defense money in an attempt to get Stickney's execution overturned. It didn't work, and Howard Stickney sat in the electric chair in 1962. If his appeals would have lasted 2 more years, when the unfortunately named Old Sparky was retired, he'd have escaped that particular fate. Before that, in 1956, Candy's oldest brother, DeWitt Weatherby, shot and killed a man after a disagreement during a $4 limit stud poker game. She and Jacques spent incredible amounts of money in an attempt to buy political influence in her brother's case, both legally and, so it's been told, under the table. Those efforts by Candy worked. Her brother, DeWitt Weatherby, was paroled after serving only 5 years of a life sentence. Perhaps Candy's sentimental weakness for hard cases started there, but the weakness for her nephew Mel Powers was something completely different. When Mel Powers showed up on his Aunt Candy's doorstep, he looked more like a chiseled man than a 19-year-old boy. With Candy's urging, Jacques hired her ruggedly handsome nephew at the Allen Parker Company, one of the multimillionaire's many Houston financial firms. Since he was new to town and came in with little to no money, Candy asked Jacques to let him move into the mansion. Jacques Mosler was nothing if not a generous person, especially with family, and was fine with the 19-year-old moving in. The finance man, according to Candy, was teaching Mel the ropes so he could eventually take over the business. In fact, she began referring to Mel Powers as a genius, a young Jacques Mosler. That's incredibly unlikely. A young Jacques Mosler, as we will see, is hardly what I would call Mel Powers. But Jacques had no idea what was going on between Aunt Candy and nephew Mel. At least not yet. In early 1962, Jacques Mosler developed a severe respiratory infection that he could not shake. After Jacques traveled to Europe for treatment at some mineral springs there, and then to his apartment in Key Biscayne to breathe in the fresh ocean air, he was slowly but surely gaining his health back. And in the meantime, Candy Mosler and Mel Powers were growing closer. During this period, the aunt and her nephew slipped away on trips together, and Mel often introduced her on vacation as his wife. That's innocuous enough, but just wait. Strangely, at Candy's direction and assistance, Mel underwent several minor surgeries. He got his ears pinned back so they wouldn't stick out so much. His acne-scarred face was smoothed. His tonsils removed, just in case he'd end up snoring otherwise, and he was circumcised. By the spring of 1962, Aunt Candy was treating her nephew to whatever he wanted, because, Mel bragged to friends and acquaintances, he was so adept at oral sex, Candy had fallen under his sexual spell. In passionate letters written between the two, Candy declared that she was in love with Mel, her big sister's son. While Jacques was away getting better and the children and caretakers were asleep, Candy would creep into Mel's bedroom at night. By the spring of 1963, the incestuous love affair between aunt and nephew was well known around the Mosler mansion. At this point, Mel Powers was 21 years old and Candy 43. Mel had been in the mansion about 14 months when Jacques found out about the affair. In May of 1983, an employee in one of Jacques' firms sat down to eat at a Houston Mexican restaurant called Felix. The young accountant looked over and noticed Candy Mosler and Mel Powers and his hand on her thigh. To the shock and disgust of Jacques' employee, he caught a glimpse of Candy grabbing Mel's crotch. The young accountant told his boss, an executive, who in turn told Jacques. It wasn't easy for the man to hear, though honestly, he knew it all along. Jacques confirmed it with his trusted, longtime cook, Alberta. The way Mel Powers treated the staff at the mansion made Jacques sick. Mel was abusive, racist, and expected them to jump through hoops for him. In fact, Jacques had grown to despise Mel. But still, he took this young man in and treated him like a son, giving him a job and a pretty damn majestic roof over his head. And even with their problems, Jacques loved his wife. Upon reading Candy's diary, the betrayal became even more strikingly and painfully obvious. Because of a prenuptial agreement, Jacques' first instinct to immediately divorce Candy was not a viable option. If he did, she'd get half of everything. That's the last thing Jacques wanted, just on principle alone. There was no justice, Jacques thought, in losing half of everything. He'd already lost so much. However, if she filed, Candy would only receive $200,000. Jacques had already ordered an executive to fire Mel Powers, who was working for him as a mobile home broker at one of his firms. Jacques' next idea was to file criminal charges against Mel for breaking up his home. Jacques visited the Harris County District Attorney, who was adamant in his opposition. The couple's life was extremely public, and the bad press might have a terrible effect on his business. But Jacques was a well-respected Houston businessman and a good guy. The DA wanted to help him, and there was one way they could. Later that day, the district attorney sent two investigators to the Mosler mansion. They confronted Mel Powers, telling him to leave or they'd arrest him for trespassing. As he left, Mel's threats did not fall on deaf ears.
"One day I'll return as the owner of this mansion,"
he reportedly said, adding,
"You, Mr. Mosler, will regret this to the longest day of your life."
These words haunted Jacques. Riddled with fear, and obviously feeling at least a little vengeful, he wrote in his personal memos, "If Mel and Candace don't kill me first, I'll have to kill them." Mel Powers was gone, at least from the Mosler mansion, but nothing could mend Jacques and Candy's broken marriage. By October of 1963, the banker millionaire was constantly paranoid and kept detailed notes of his wife's telephone conversations, if he happened to overhear them. Jacques Mosler had already begun the process of revising his will, and he and Candy separated. For emotional respite, and to escape the embarrassment he felt over Candy's incestuous affair becoming the talk of the city's elite, Jacques traveled to Europe for an extended stay. When he returned to the States, he still sought to avoid his high society peers in Houston, and opted instead to stay in his small but luxurious apartment in Key Biscayne, Florida. With the prenuptial agreement in place, Jacques Mosler didn't dare make the move toward divorce, nor did Candy, since she'd only get $200,000 if she did, and she was currently living the high life. So the two simply stayed in their places, Candy back in Houston and Jacques in Florida. Aunt Candy continued the sexual relationship with her nephew, visiting his apartment in Houston quite often. She'd given Mel money to start his own mobile home business, and she could easily afford it since Jacques was giving her $5,000 a week. Mel Powers had not forgotten about Jacques throwing him out of the mansion. To the contrary, he was stewing. Employees of the new business, in fact, witnessed the young man's threats to kill Jacques Mosler on many occasions. Sometimes, Candy Mosler traveled to Florida with the couple's adopted children in tow so Jacques could spend time with them. After the 1964 school year let out in May, she packed up her daughter from her previous marriage and three of she and Jacques' kids to spend the summer with their father. It was a little cramped in the two-bedroom unit at the Governor's Lodge apartments in Key Biscayne, but Jacques was thrilled to have the kids there. He was most likely less than thrilled to have his cheating wife along for the ride. On June 24th and 26th, between 1 a.m. and sunrise each time, Candy loaded up the children and drove to Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, seeking treatment for what she called debilitating migraine headaches. Each time, Jacques remained at his apartment alone, save his canine companion, a boxer named Rocky. A few nights later, when Candy again visited the hospital for treatment for her headaches, the circumstances surrounding the trip were bizarre, and Jacques Mosler ended up dead. We'll pick up the story from there on part two. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the co-ed killer, Dr. Dreadful, the Butcher Painter, and our latest there, The Tourniquet Killer Parts 1 and 2, among others. Part 3 will be up soon. It's already written. I've just got to get the time to record and edit. Any day now. Also, we'll be mailing out stuff soon to those of y'all at the Bomb City and above levels. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us there. We could not do this without you, and we appreciate it beyond words. The Chicago Tribune, the Houston Chronicle, The Washington Post, The LA Times, The Miami Sun Sentinel, TrueTV.com, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.